Good afternoon, and welcome to today's program sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Northern California and the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Jane Wales, President of the World Affairs Council. We also welcome those joining us on the radio for today's program and invite our listeners to visit the World Affairs Council on the web at wacsf.org and the Commonwealth Club also on the web at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's speaker. Our speaker today is the Honorable John Kerry, Senator from Massachusetts. Senator Kerry is now in his third term in the U.S. Senate, representing Massachusetts. He's a ranking member of the Senate Small Business Committee and serves on the Foreign Relations Committee, Banking Committee, Commerce and Intelligence Committee. Senator Kerry also serves in the Senate Democratic Leadership as Chairman of the Steering and Coordination Committee. John Kerry was first elected to public office as Lieutenant Governor in 1982 and was then elected to the Senate shortly thereafter in 1984. He was reelected in 1990 and again in 1996, defeating a popular Republican governor, William Weld. A graduate of Yale University, Senator Kerry entered the Navy after graduation, became an officer on the gunboat in the Mekong Delta in Vietnam. He received a Silver Star, a Bronze Star, and three awards of the Purple Heart for his service in combat. Upon his return, he became an active leader of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War and a co-founder of the Vietnam Veterans of America. He attended Boston College Law School, and after graduating, Senator John Kerry worked as a prosecutor in the Middlesex County before entering politics. So please join me in welcoming Senator John Kerry.
Jane, thank you very much for a warm and generous welcome. I'm delighted to be here with all of you at this joint meeting of the World Affairs Council and the Commonwealth Club, both of which are organizations that I have enormous respect for. I have often listened to discourses from this podium and learned from them, and so I'm honored to be here today, and I hope that I can be perhaps wise, even as I am provocative, and I certainly look forward to the dialogue that we can have in the question-answer period, which I'm very pleased to wander a little bit in, if you would like to go beyond just China and examine some of the other questions of international importance that we face right now. But I really am delighted to be here with you. I guess if the truth be known, as an elected member of the much abused and distrusted federal establishment, I'm really delighted to be invited anywhere, folks. But I'm particularly pleased to be here with all of you, especially to talk about this enormously important topic about China. I have the privilege of serving as the ranking member of the Asia Subcommittee, and in that regard, have had my eye on the entire region for some period of time now. And obviously, few foreign policy issues are or should be as important to our thinking right now and our analysis than our often tumultuous but critically important relationship with China. Americans have always been intrigued with China because of its mystery, its potential. There is a great folklore that has accompanied all of our involvement in that part of the world. And our approaches have been driven, in my judgment, by a complex mixture of respect, romanticism, paternalism, and wariness, with one or the other attitude dominating, depending on what may be happening at a particular moment. Our varied understanding of the world's most populous nation not only enables willing politicians in our country to demagogue the issue in domestic politics, but it also empowers the Chinese leadership to manipulate the relationship by playing up our perception of China as somehow special. And as a result, reaching consensus on China policy within our own country, as we have seen and will see in the debate, though it will pass in the Senate more easily than in the House, as we've seen in the debate on permanent and normal trade relations. Let me say at the very beginning, as a framework for my comments, that the administration correctly put the PNTR vote at the top of the agenda. But make no mistake about it. The outcome of this vote does not issue in a new era of relations with China or a new consensus between the administration and the Congress over how or even whether to engage. It was fundamentally a vote that pitted immediate and compelling business interests against labor and environmental interests and human rights interests in an election year. And the president had to pull out all the stops to narrowly win House approval of a deal which saw China make all the concessions. Even then, he managed to get only one-third of the members of his own party to back what he described as a no-brainer. The House vote simply signals that a small majority of members were not and are not willing to subordinate normal trade relations to concerns about what they consider to be a larger set of issues, both moral and otherwise. And that will continue. These concerns will continue to bedevil the relationship, as well as new concerns that will arise about the degree to which China fulfills its commitments to the WTO and follows through on its bilateral agreements with the United States and with other countries. Now, I personally support PNTR, and I commend the administration for its determined and successful campaign, and I believe that the vote in the Senate should be, on a relative basis, larger and more confirming of our desire to try to move forward, at least with respect to the trade relationship. Accession to the WTO is an example of where the administration has successfully engaged China. But in my judgment, and I think in the judgment of other thoughtful people, there are many areas where this administration and even prior administrations have succeeded in fueling a fairly intense debate with strong divisions over what is the correct way to try to manage this relationship. I want to warn you today of what I think is perhaps one of the most important things we need to think about as we proceed forward. The debate on China today offers a false choice, a choice between a Cold War-style containment and the current form of engagement, which is perceived to be an engagement at almost all costs. I believe that containment of China along the lines of the policy that we pursued with the Soviet Union, and I wouldn't be arguing this if it weren't for the fact that my colleagues in the United States Congress on the other side of the aisle argue the very proposition I'm seeking to argue against, which is that we should pursue a policy not dissimilar to what we pursued with the former Soviet Union. I believe that to do so is neither necessary nor prudent. In fact, could be entirely counterproductive, even dangerous. Engagement is the right approach, but it needs to be a hard-headed engagement and an engagement that is clearly driven by our interests and by a much greater degree of multilateral cooperation. To promote interests effectively, I believe that engagement has to be rooted in four principles that have not been clearly adhered to in the last years. They are clarity, consistency, pragmatism, and accountability. And these are principles to which I will return in a few moments. Let me frame this first in a starting point that I think is the most important thing for us, all of us, to keep in mind as we think about how you create a policy with respect to this enormously large, and though I have said not to be a special relationship, nevertheless, important relationship, critical relationship. China today cannot be deemed a strategic partner or a close friend, but it is not an enemy. as the proponents of containment would have us believe. An American attempt to contain China would, number one, be certain to fail, and number two, would create dangerous tensions which do not now and need not exist. It would feed into the growing nationalism and even paranoia, so much in evidence after our planes bombed China's Belgrade embassy. It would strengthen the belief among Chinese officials that they should accelerate their own military modernization to counter what they perceive to be an encirclement from a growing American threat, a perception, I might add, reinforced by the Clinton doctrine of humanitarian intervention and NATO's intervention in Kosovo. Don't underestimate the legitimacy of not just Chinese, but of European and other nations' concern about that. In short, with the wrong choices, we can secure precisely the outcome that we want to avoid and that proponents of containment fear: a hostile China aggressively pursuing an arms race that we neither need nor want. The worst thing that we could do is allow those who see China as an enemy today to make it into the enemy that it is not and that we don't want it to be. In addition, we know from our Cold War experience with the Soviet Union that containment works only if it's implemented multilaterally. We frankly saw that most effectively with sanctions also with respect to South Africa as compared to the 60-plus or more nations that we have sanctions against today unilaterally. But the point is, U.S. allies, our best friends in the world, do not see the need to contain China in that way. And they're not prepared to sacrifice their hard-won trading relationships with a China that boasts an increasingly dynamic market economy. Even now, our Asian allies, to whom we should look and listen, and who clearly have the most reason immediately to fear China, do not view it as an expansionist power. They want us engaged because they believe it will encourage China's responsibility and create stability in a region where three powerful players, China, the United States, and Japan, vie for influence. Now remember, China has the capacity to hinder or to help us on a clear and critical set of priorities to United States national interests. They can advance our interests on any number of things, ranging from proliferation, non-proliferation, open markets and free trade, environmental protection, international global climate change responses, the promotion of human rights and democratic freedoms, counterterrorism, counter-narcotics, Asian economic recovery, peace on the Korean Peninsula, and ultimately peace and stability in the entire region. It is only by engaging with China that we're going to make any kind of positive progress on any of those priorities and thereby advance our interests and, I underscore, our national security. Engagement does not guarantee that we're going to have the outcome we want on every one of these, nor does it even guarantee that China will be a friend or a, quote, strategic partner. But by integrating China into the international community through engagement, we minimize the possibility of China moving in the opposite direction and of creating an outcome that would be negative to our national interests and to the long-term stability and security of the region. Now, Americans, for whatever reasons, often fail to fully take note. I mean, it's hard in America today to create the kind of dialogue that we're having here. The news organizations, and I welcome the fact you'll be having Joe Klein, who is an extraordinary observer of the American political dynamic, but he would agree with me, as do many of the most professional of our news gatherers and reporters in Washington, that news is transforming politics into entertainment, not into substance, not into the kind of dialogue we need to have. And so it is that it's even more difficult to get people to build consensus about a whole set of issues, including China. And they fail, therefore, to recognize that the last 30 years of engagement, since Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger opened up the process, have actually produced remarkable tangible benefits for a broad range of interests, including trade, arms control, and even, yes, even human rights. Now, obviously, China still has a long way to travel with respect to improving those rights for its citizens. But the record is not entirely bleak, and that is an honest and dispassionate assessment. In fact, that's one of the contradictions. There are two faces of life in China today. The first face is the disturbing crackdown on the Falun Gong, the increase of repressive, destructive activities in Tibet, the restraints placed on key democracy advocates, and the harassment of underground churches. But the second face is that of the average citizen, who I can remember from 10 years ago when I was in China versus today, had far fewer rights of access, travel, capacity to work, and income, and standard of living than they have today. In fact, they couldn't move off the street without checking with their work committee at the particular block that they lived on. Today, they can move anywhere, freedom of movement, capacity to be employed. And while leaders remain intent on controlling political activity, undeniably there are indications that the limits of that system are beginning to transition, fade, and there are increasing encouragements to political activists to take previously unimaginable steps, including the formation of an alternative democracy party. Now, does that meet with paranoia, fear, restraint, restriction, oppression, resistance? The answer is yes, still. But you still have to measure that on the whole, Chinese citizens have more personal freedom than they ever had before. And you have to ask yourself why. Now, we will continue to press for further change, but we cannot create a China policy for the modern world that doesn't take into account the reality of what is happening. So the central issue, in my judgment, for all of us to think about is not whether to engage China, even though there are those debating that in Washington. It is how do we engage China? How do we do so in a prudent, more effective way that advances our national interests in a global age and keeps faith with our values? I'd suggest that for too long, this administration and others appear to have approached engagement almost with a public perception that they are driven more by China's concerns than by our own national interests. And the consensus for engagement with China has, in fact, been seriously undermined, in my judgment, by this fact. To some extent, the criticism leveled at the administration is simply partisan politics, and that has to also be put on the table. And that has led some in Congress to careen from one hot-button issue to another hot-button issue, undermining the serious interests at stake. And I'm talking about, obviously, some of the issues of campaign financing and questions of nuclear secrets and so forth. But beyond the politics, there is a genuine disagreement over the way in which the administration has engaged. And I think the recent PNTR vote in the House does not fundamentally change that. On some initiatives, the administration has had success in dealing with China, and they've been correct. They moved quickly to abandon the counterproductive MFN human rights linkage. In the 1996 Straits crisis, it sent China a very clear and important message by positioning U.S. carriers off the coast of Taiwan. It properly emphasized the importance of Chinese participation in arms control regimes, with partial success in obtaining Chinese cooperation on arms control norms. It focused the international spotlight on China's human rights violations at the Human Rights Commission in Geneva this past year, even as it announced its intention to proceed forward on the trade status. And it successfully concluded the trade agreement itself, I think, in the interest of American economic potential. But in its handling of other elements of the relationship, I would respectfully suggest that there have been problems that linger and that create difficulties as we try to build a greater consensus in this country, as well as a clarity and consistency in the relationship with China itself. For instance, unrealistic expectations were raised about the benefits of engagement with China, and that underplayed the real differences that separate us and therefore made it more difficult to be able to appeal to people who are harder line on the human rights or other issues because they didn't perceive that that was somehow on the horizon, adequately spoken to, and being pushed. For example, the administration clung far too long, in my judgment, to the idea of China as a strategic partner. It is not. The common interest that we share with China, whether it's establishing peace on the Korean Peninsula, stabilizing Russia, or halting the arms race, or any of the other things that I mentioned a moment ago, all make engagement necessary, but the serious differences between us, human rights, democracy, American support for Taiwan, those prevent us at this moment from being what we would normally call in the vernacular of diplomacy and of strategic relationships, friends. By adopting that particular rhetoric in the past years, the administration fed the public perception that something better was in the offing. And it helped to gloss over some of those differences that I'm talking about that helped to build a consensus about how we are adhering to our value system even as we push for engagement. I might add that out of an apparent fear of offending Beijing, the administration made decisions, several of them, that seemed to play into China's hand. For instance, again, the initial refusal to extend a visa to then-Taiwan President Lee Teng-hui, I thought, was only exacerbated the sense of ambivalence. And President Clinton's announcement of the three no's while he was in Shanghai on a trip where he went nowhere else raised concerns both in Congress and in Taiwan that there was a tilt towards Beijing on the critical issue of Taiwan. Now, these may only be perceptions, but as everybody here understands, in politics and particularly in diplomacy, perceptions become reality, and perceptions need to be dealt with politically, often as much as realities. These concerns were reinforced by the administration's attempts to quell Beijing's furor over Lee's July 1999 pronouncement that relations between Taiwan and China should be state to state. The administration's steadfast refusal to include a stop in Seoul or in Tokyo as part of President Clinton's trip to China was designed not to offend the Chinese, but not to bolster allies and friends, at the risk of diminishing the importance of our relationship with those key friends in the region. By failing to press China more firmly on sensitive issues such as human rights or nonproliferation or trade violations, the message was then sent that engagement became an end in and of itself. For example, the administration repeatedly passed on sanctioning China for the sale of M-11 missiles to Pakistan, as did its predecessor, out of a fundamental concern for throwing off engagement. But the failure to be direct and upfront undermined the confidence in Congress and in some parts of the world and in this country about their willingness to hold China accountable. The question then is, obviously, so how do we proceed from here? Well, it's clear that the next administration, Democratic or Republican, will maintain the policy of engagement with China. That's now on the table as part of their platforms. The challenge both either one would face is to find a way to engage China more effectively in order to better serve the national interests that I talked about, as well as to rebuild the consensus in this country in support of that kind of engagement. As the current administration has learned all too well, the failure to maintain that consensus has led Congress to take actions that sometimes raise the tensions between Washington and Beijing and further complicate our ability to be able to do the things that are in our interest. So here are the three things that I think we need to focus on as we go forward. First, we must recognize that engagement is not an objective in and of itself. Engagement is a process through which the United States and China pursue respective interests, some mutual, some not. Given the differences between us, engagement has to be viewed as a long-term engagement, long-term goal, and we must expect bumps along the road. When China takes actions to which we object, whether toward Taiwan or its own citizens, we can't let the fear of disrupting the engagement process restrain us from making clear what our values and our position is in substance with respect to those actions. And we need to do that in public as well as in private at certain moments. Second, we must reject the idea of this specialness that I talked about earlier and operate in a way that doesn't empower Beijing to feel that because America is running around tripping over itself with this sense of specialness, that they can somehow manipulate our actions or our policies. China is obviously an enormously complex society. We need to understand it better, and we need to respect some of those complexities. But in the final analysis, our foreign policy must be dictated, as our foreign policy always must be dictated, by our own definition of our national and international interests. Third, the next administration, I think, has to retool the engagement so that it's rooted in the four principles that I talked about earlier, the clarity, consistency, pragmatism, and accountability. Now, you know, you could say, well, those sound like sort of, goo-gooey words. What does that really mean? Let me tell you what it really means, because I think you can hang your hat on some realities with respect to those principles. First, clarity. Our national interests with respect to China have to be more clearly articulated so that we don't lurch from one crisis to the next or from one sense of priority to the next. Americans need to understand all of the things that I just said. Most Americans don't have a clue why it's important to be involved with China. Most Americans think the key is just trade or human rights. But they don't think about Korea. They don't think about a vote at the United Nations, where if we don't have a tacit approval, at least we don't have their outright veto, so that we can engage in the way we have, whether it was Haiti or whether it's Bosnia or Kosovo or any other number of interests where difficulties could arise. That part of the defining process needs to take place much more frequently, much more forcefully, and much more clearly. And people need to understand what the bumps in the road may be and how we have this broad range of interests, such as human rights or trade, but how if one goes up and the other's down, we don't undermine our ability to pursue all of them simultaneously. By clearly stating those interests and our goals, we can stay focused on those issues of real importance and avoid the harmful distractions. We need also to give China a clear sense of our priorities and expectations. Hesitating to publicly and quickly reject China's expanded threat to use force against Taiwan, for instance, which was issued in the White Paper in February, sent a blurred message to China about where we are with respect to Taiwan. And I heard that not just in the halls of Congress, where there was an immediate reaction and we had a hearing, but I heard it in other places. Similarly, speaking with Chinese officials about the importance of human rights or arms control is not enough. If we fail to follow up with concrete policy steps, such as meeting with democracy advocates in Beijing or elsewhere, or imposing sanctions for proliferation violations, paying lip service to those important issues again sends the wrong message about our expectations of progress, and it undermines public confidence in engagement as a policy that truly serves the interests of the American people. Now, I fully understand the usefulness and the nuances of quiet, private diplomacy. I support back-channel diplomacy. But it cannot be the principal or only means of conveying America's concerns. We must be willing to combine words and deeds to deliver the messages publicly as well as privately if Beijing is to understand the full measure of our seriousness, which is why I so supported, finally, the clear demarcation the administration took in proceeding in Geneva to try to push the human rights, even as we proceeded on the other track to do the trade. That is exactly the kind of clarity that I'm talking about. Clarity is also impossible to achieve if you don't have consistency. The next administration has to strive to avoid the kind of flip-flops that we've seen over the last 12 years or more. On controversial questions such as President Lee's visit to the U.S. or Zhu Rongji's April 1999 WTO offer, these missteps confuse, they delay, they lead to misperceptions, and they empower hardliners and doubters within the Chinese political structure who are working hard to restrain reform and movement in the directions that we would like to see. No one can forget that. I mean, we have this simplicity that seems to overtake us sometimes. We have complexities in our own body politic, but we always seem to think that other countries can proceed however it is that we want them to proceed, but not necessarily the way they can proceed according to their own culture and capacities within their country. And so pragmatism has to be a fundamental element of our engagement. We've got to be more realistic about our expectations of progress over both the short and the long term. Concluding a WTO agreement, for instance, is a short-term goal. Promoting human rights and change in China is a long-term objective. And success or failure is not simply a function of our bilateral relationship. We must realize that China's fractious history and the incredible compelling desire of the current leadership to maintain power has embedded in its leaders, and if you look at Chinese history through all of this century, you see this in the difficulties of creating the center in China and the difficulties of the cultural upheavals that they've had, both forced and otherwise, that it underscores the deep-rooted fear of too much change too rapidly and creates a resistance to anything that might undermine the magic words stability and cohesion. Our ability to influence China varies, notwithstanding our wonderful sense of self and our desire to change the world overnight. The fact is that policymakers in the executive branch and the Congress must convey more clearly to the American people some of those realities and difficulties with respect to change. That is one of the reasons why we need to work harder on the multilateral front, which is a much more powerful weapon than one that we often pursue. Working closely with our allies, we need to encourage China to become a responsible member of the international community. And the more we can bring China into the international standards and norms, be it on trade or arms control, the greater the stake China will have in abiding by them, and the more accountable China will be to the international community if it fails to do so. We need to also be more realistic about the tone that we use in dialogue. A dialogue with another powerful nation must be just that, a dialogue, not a monologue. The message must go beyond accede to our demands on our schedule. A real dialogue with China will seek to define not only the areas and the ways in which we can cooperate, but also the areas where we disagree and sometimes even the ways in which we might disagree. That is, incidentally, something that Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger sort of clarified in the early understandings when the Shanghai communique was issued. And by defining cooperative steps on a host of issues, you will build the foundation for real dialogue and enhance your capacity for progress. Realistic changes need to also embrace a very significant increase, in my judgment, in personal diplomacy. Whenever I am in many parts of Asia on committee business, I'm always struck by the number of people who say to me, "Senator, where's the United States?" They want us there. They know they need us there. Many of those countries rely on us deeply for our capacity to be able to provide stability in the region. And the French, the Japanese, the Germans, the Australians, and many others are, in terms of personal diplomacy, often far more present and felt. And I believe that our relationship with China and a range of interests in the region can be promoted far more effectively when the President, Vice President, Secretary of State, high ministerial level officials are building personal, ongoing relationships with their counterparts. And that takes time and energy. Improving, therefore, the clarity, the consistency, and the pragmatism of our approach to China will not produce results in the end if we are also not prepared to hold China accountable for its actions. That means triggering the enforcement mechanisms within international institutions, such as the Human Rights Commission or the ILO, or soon the WTO, and enforcing our own domestic laws with respect to issues such as proliferation or human rights. The international community must insist that China be responsible for full compliance with its commitments, and it has not always been. And when Chinese actions contradict international norms or the promises they've made to us, we've got to be willing to say so. Now, obviously, the most difficult issue in our engagement with China, and the one which could draw us into conflict, is Taiwan. Today, Taiwan is a very different place than it was when President Nixon went to China in 1972. And that complicates the situation for American policymakers. Reunification was the overriding objective for the Chinese that fled the mainland in 1949. But it is not for the younger generation of Chinese who have grown up on Taiwan, or for even native Taiwanese who have no desire to be part of China. The key question then is, how do you proceed to advance cross-strait stability even as you again keep faith with the substance of who we are as a nation and the value system on which we have based our outward-looking efforts globally? I believe it is essential not to alter the basics of U.S. policy towards Taiwan. I won't bore you now by going through each step since 1972. There's been a marginal transition since that first communique, but Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger made it very, very clear at the outset that our relationship was essentially a one-China policy. And for almost 30 years, the cornerstone of our approach has been this so-called one-China policy. There is but one China, Taiwan is a part of China, and the question of Taiwan's future must be settled peacefully. Now, while Taiwan has changed in dramatic and important ways since we first articulated the one China policy, I believe that it's wrong to abandon that policy and support, on the other hand, independence for Taiwan. I believe that would be enormously dangerous, both for U.S. interests and for Taiwan. The one China policy serves our interests, and it enhances Taiwan's security as long as we continue to make it clear to China, as the administration did during the 1996 Strait crisis, that a military solution to reunification is unacceptable. Now, some have argued that we should abandon our deliberate ambiguity about the circumstances under which we would come to Taiwan's defense. And although I have argued that we need to inject more clarity into our engagement, this is the one place where I believe that our interests and Taiwan's and China's are better served by the current ambiguity. It not only deters a Chinese attack, but it discourages Taiwan from assuming that it can make a decision on its own as to when the United States would go to war. It also reduces their capacity to simply draw us into some kind of conflict. And while it's very tempting to lay down sort of a specific set of lines as to when and how you might respond, when you really analyze those lines, I believe it becomes considerably unwise. There really is no comprehensive list of conditions under which you can say you would defend without creating great question marks as to who did what first, whether it really falls under a definition or doesn't, and in fact becomes an invitation to a hair trigger that we are specifically trying to avoid. To draw up such a list in an effort to remove strategic ambiguity runs the risk of inviting loophole chasing and credibility testing steps which decrease Taiwan's security and eliminate our own flexibility. Second, we must support the resumption of the cross-state negotiations and encourage moderation by both sides. And if tensions are to subside and the dialogue is to flourish, Taiwan will have to move carefully and avoid provocation, and Beijing, in turn, must avoid the temptation, avoid the temptation to see every single Taiwanese move as provocative and respond disproportionately. President Chen Shui-bian's election obviously did not provide a clear mandate on the reunification question, but make no mistake, he clearly understands this. And in his inaugural address, as well as in his comments immediately subsequent to the election, I think he has moved adroitly to recognize the sensitivities and to help to create the framework within which he can be sort of the modern-day Nixon going to China, so to speak. Some people see the glass or saw the glass when he was elected as half empty. I tend to see it half full, that this has created an enormous moment of opportunity. And if both sides will proceed adroitly, I think we have an opportunity to move forward. In his to resolve the issue, Beijing has got to recognize that Taiwan is not Macau or Hong Kong, and the one country, two systems rhetoric formula is a non-starter. Beijing is going to need to think more creatively, but clearly there are several formulas that many people can define by which one could proceed forward here. One thing is clear: no American president, no Congress could or would allow a diminishment of the level of democracy that has been achieved. No politician could survive, and I think you understand that. But far more important than that, no one should accept it, because it would be completely contrary to every principle and every part of who we are as a people and what we have encouraged people to become. So there are ways still to integrate. And one of the things we need to do is not gum up the works ourselves. The Taiwan Security Enhancement Act, which has passed the House and is pending in the Senate, currently builds a more formal military relationship that goes beyond unofficial ties with Taiwan. And to pass the Taiwan Security Enhancement Act at this time, in my judgment, would create enormous tensions in the Strait. It would destroy the opportunity of this moment after the election, and it would invite some kind of military response from Beijing. In short, it's not a Taiwan Security Enhancement Act. It is a Taiwan Security Diminishment Act, and we should think carefully before passing it. Finally, we need to acknowledge that there can be no military balance in the Straits without the United States of America. No amount of arms sales are going to enable Taiwan to defend itself against that short span of distance and against a country the size of China if it were intent on proceeding militarily. No amount of sale of arms to Taiwan alone could do it. So we should be clear about our strategic needs and capacity and towards the whole theory of strategic force in the Straits. And we must demonstrate through our robust diplomatic and military presence that we will guard vigilantly against any threat to stability in the Asia Pacific. In the final analysis, history and a clear understanding of our national interests mandate that we engage with China, but that we do so in a more explicit way, acknowledging the short-term benefits may be limited. Long-term challenges are real, and we need to anchor China in the international community. That's our challenge, and the outcome is clearly critical to all of us, not just to administrations, but to our children and to future generations. Thank you for the privilege of talking to you.
Thank you, Senator Kerry, for your comprehensive review and succinct set of recommendations for U.S.-China relations. I'm now going to turn the podium and the gavel over to Dr. Joseph Fink. Dr. Fink is, as you know, the president of Dominican University of California and the chairman of the Commonwealth Club of California's program committee. Dr. Fink.
Thank you, Jane Wells, president of the World Affairs Council. Excuse me. Senator Kerry, you gave a very comprehensive and thorough talk, and it seemed every time I selected a question to be asked, you went on to cover it a minute or so later. Fortunately, we have a few other questions that we might be able to ask you to allow you to elaborate on some of the things that you had mentioned. First of all, if you're giving a speech in China, what would you be telling your audience about relations with the United States?
That's a very, very good question. I think I would. I don't know how many of you read what President Clinton said when he was over there. I thought that was a pretty good statement. I think the important thing is to underscore to the Chinese our respect for their culture, our understanding of their history, and the mutual goals, that the capacity for us to be able to work together to make the world better in so many ways. Ultimately, the goal should be to have the strategic partnership that some have sort of suggested had existed at some point in prior time. And I would talk about how we can define that strategic relationship and how these interests bind us together and the ways in which people who have come from China to the United States as immigrants have contributed to the strength of our nation and to our own viability today, and show the ways in which we could really break down some of these walls of fear and suspicion and paranoia and resistance. I would very clearly talk to them about the values and virtues of democracy. I wouldn't hesitate, as I think most people have gone there do. I've had those conversations privately with leaders. I can tell when they're falling on deaf ears, and I can tell when they're falling on sort of ambivalence and even sometimes interested ears. But over time, there is change. President Lee Kuan Yew of Singapore, who we met with in Washington lately, suggested to us that there is an enormous transition bubbling up, that the younger generation has a very different outlook, and that the octogenarians that are currently in power and capable of suppressing and still staying on the course of the long march, so to speak, are going to be replaced increasingly by people who see the world differently, who are educated at Stanford, and, Cambridge, Oxford, Harvard, other places in our country, traveled the world and are accessing the world. And increasingly, as the world globalizes and as we all get closer, the opportunities to come together are just enormous. So I think I would frame it very much in that way and try to create the dialogue that I talked about, not lecturing, but talking and trying to promote the virtues of why we're coming from where we are so they can understand it.
Thank you. This member of the audience agrees with the strategic partnership. However, they also wish to know, how do we develop a comprehensive and truly enforceable statement of standards that does protect human rights, the environment, and other issues that are important to U.S. values?
Well, I think we've made that statement. I mean, I don't think there's any question in the United States about what we stand for in terms of human rights, that we don't want prison labor, we don't want child abuse, we don't want people being exploited. We would ultimately like people to have the opportunity to collectively bargain, to be able to organize. I mean, there are a whole series, the right to politically affiliate, the right for people to practice their freedom of religion, for churches to, and so forth. I mean, all of these things are defined and clear, I think. What is not clear is how we will leverage them and what places we choose to make those fights. For instance, the ILO. We have already signed on, as have most countries of the world, including China, the International Labor Standards, but we don't enforce them. We don't push them within the ILO. We do that neither at the United Nations, nor in Geneva, nor in other fora where we could do this. So I think it's more a question of this, of what I was talking about in the substance of my remarks, of being consistent and being clear, of defining where we're going to fight those things and then fighting them, and not setting ourselves up so that a fight on one of those things destroys our capacity to move in one of the other areas. Now, I don't want to be accused of being simplistic. I understand how difficult diplomacy is sometimes and how a nation will look you in the eye and their leader will say to you, well, if you insist on proceeding down this road, there's no way we're going to sign this other agreement with you. Or if you're going to embarrass us at this particular effort, we're going to have a hard time reaching agreement on this. So there's a yin and a yang, not to be, amusing about it or otherwise, but there really is. There's that tension and balance in it. You have to find it. What I'm suggesting is we haven't found it properly, and we have to sometimes take risks stronger on the side of the things that really are attached to our value system. And that's how we will build the stronger consensus for proceeding forward on those things which are not so connected to values, but are connected to economic well-being. And I think that's the distinction.
Thank you. You mentioned during your talk comments about Taiwan and how we would work in a different model other than the model existing with Hong Kong. Can you give us an example or two of such a model?
Well, I want to be a little bit careful here, but I think I can be somewhat explicit without framing an entire solution at this point in time. The answer is more clearly in the tax structure, in the relationship of the police force, the military, and ultimately in the memberships that are permitted in certain kinds of standing organizations on a global basis, et cetera. It seems to me, and also the sort of continued guarantees as to complete and absolute political freedom. As I said earlier, I cannot envision a reunification that diminishes the level of democracy. I don't think the United States would live with that. I don't think the free world would live with that. And I know Taiwanese would want to resist that, and appropriately should. So China is going to have to find a formula here which is different from either of the other two, which are more strictly connected politically, and create, and I hate to use the word federated, but, you know, some, and I'm not going to use that word, but I'm throwing it out for an image, create some kind of, and this is where I said we've got to be creative, create a relationship where Taiwanese can say, we are part of China, but at the same time not have stepped backwards from the gains they have made in terms of their individual liberties, freedom, and political structure. And so, again, the relationship of the military, their defense structure, the control over the police, their political autonomy within that, quote, united structure is the key. In some cases, my friends, these things are words and understandings. And it is a reflection of as much an intent and a will on both sides as it will be sort of the difficulty of creating the structure. I think that the latter, what I've just described to you, the will and the intent and finding the right political dynamic is far more complicated than finding the words and the formula. And the sooner we get about the business of having that dialogue and of understanding clearly where the parties are and where the latitude to move is, we can begin down that road. But we need to do that in a serious way soon.
Thank you. This questioner is a firm supporter of the National Missile Defense Plan possibility. What is your position in that regard, and what impact would it have upon our relations with China?
I'm delighted to get that question. I've been doing a lot of thinking lately about the National Missile Defense Plan, and I have some strong feelings about it. I would be in favor of the deployment of a mutually agreed upon, effective, and limited defense system that has as its purpose solely knocking down a, quote, rogue missile, accidental launch, or rogue/terrorist missile, accidental launch. Now, those are the only rationales which you can find in the current configuration to say, let's deploy a defense under any circumstances. I might add, if you go through the thinking process of analyzing the nature of the threat of a rogue missile, or, you know, accidental launch is more problematical, but rogue missile, I mean, is North Korea really going to take one, two, or three missiles and aim them at the United States for what purpose? To be annihilated from the face of the earth within minutes afterwards? I mean, notwithstanding that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, Saddam Hussein did not use them during the time that we went to war with him. Why? Because defense deterrence does work. It worked with the former Soviet Union for 45 years, and it works today even, with Gaddafi, with mad people, so to speak. Now, that doesn't mean I'm willing to subject any American to the potential real threat, and I would not, which is why I would seek to have a mutual, limited, effective system that you could agree on. And I agree with Ronald Reagan. The only way you will get people to have that kind of mutuality and confidence is fundamentally to share and to do it on a mutual basis, if indeed your purpose is to address the threat of rogue or accidental. Now, the problem is if you do it unilaterally, you invite all of the perception problems that I talked about earlier that create arms races. And all you have to do is go back to the arms race of the last 50 years to make that analysis. We fired the first atom bomb. The Soviets followed. We fired the first hydrogen bomb. The Soviets followed. We did the first MIRVing. They followed. They did the first ICBM. I think Sputnik and so forth was the only area they were first, and they did some submarine breakthroughs. Otherwise, we were entirely first, incidentally, every single step of that arms race. First people with long-range bombers, so forth and so on. Now, the inevitable result is everybody, the others follow, because they perceive that their strategic balance is upset by what the other side has done. And whether it takes them 5 years to do it, or 10 years to do it, or 15 years to do it, they'll try to do it if they feel their security is at risk. That's why we put the ABM treaty in place, because after years and years and years of spending trillions of dollars creating more and more warheads, where we both had more than 10,000 warheads, we finally decided we want a world that's safer. And the world that's safer, we decided, began to ratchet down the numbers of warheads. So we're now with START 2, moving on to START 3, going from 6,700 warheads down to 3,500, and we want to get down conceivably to 2,200, 1,500, which is the big debate today. If we unilaterally put a defense system in place that can be perceived by the Russians as having the capacity to knock down their missiles so that we've created somewhat of a shield, then you are inviting people to keep their missiles on hair trigger. You're even inviting them to build more missiles. And to answer your question specifically with respect to China, which has only about 20 to 23 long-range missiles that could hit the United States, if you have more than 100 to 200 under their current plan for missile defense, capacity to shoot down 20 to 23 missiles, what are you going to do if you're the Chinese? You're going to start building more, because that's the only way you'll feel that you can't be overwhelmed by the United States in case there was a major confrontation. It is not, you see, offense and defense can be confused. Defense, if it's really impregnable and capable, can become offense, because you actually create a first strike capacity if you have the ability to knock down the missiles that can be sent back at you that maintain the balance of terror. Now, I hate the balance of terror. We all do, folks. But the truth is that for 50 years, it worked. And it maintained a capacity for us not to be rash and invade North Vietnam and risk a land war with Chinese. And it maintained the capacity of Russia and others not to challenge us in various places and so forth. And as a former soldier who remembers what it's like to be on the front line shooting at other human beings, I do not want to go back to a world where we've made it easier for people to make decisions that they can just put the troops out in the field and let them go at it, and it doesn't run the risk of this other kind of conflagration. So we have to think carefully about how we come out of this safer and what we're trying to do. And I believe, as I said, if the defense is thoughtful, mutual, we both benefit, we both have the ability to knock down an accidental launch or a rogue missile, we are safer. But if we initiate an arms race and do it unilaterally without anybody else having the technology so that we gain a technological edge, we're inviting a restoration of the arms race that sapped so much of America's resources over so many years.
Thank you. This next question only has 5 words, but I think it's clear enough. If China, why not Cuba?
Well, I think we have to begin to rethink our policy towards Cuba. I think Elian Gonzalez wouldn't have even happened if we'd had a more enlightened policy with respect to Cuba. But we need to think about how we're going to do that. I'm not just for unilaterally going pop and you change it. I think you want to negotiate through it. I think you want to be thoughtful about what you're going to get for it. Too many people have an ability to romanticize Castro's government in this country. It doesn't deserve that gloss. Trust me. If you're concerned about human rights in China, you ought to be concerned about them in Cuba, too. People have been killed. People are separated from families. People are imprisoned. They don't allow You know, you can go down there to a hotel and you'll get CNN, but no one else in the country will. It is a very closed, spy-filled, fundamentally sort of Stalinist government in the sense of how it's structured to have information, restrain the flow of thought, and restrict people's access to the liberties that we all enjoy and take for granted here. That said, I think Castro is almost, in sort of secondary in the context of things today, and there'll be a biological resolution of that part of the equation. The question is, what are we going to do to lay the groundwork so the people there have a better sense of what alternatives they will have? And in my judgment, having cultural exchanges, allowing greater visitation rights for people, encouraging more exchanges and negotiating through this process is entirely to our long-term benefit, just as it is in China. And I think we need to rethink how we're going to proceed through that.
We have time for one or two non-foreign policy questions. The first, what do you believe will be President Clinton's place in history? Will it be about impeachment or much beyond?
Well, I think it's going to be significantly beyond that. I mean, first of all, he's the first Democratic president to be reelected and serve two terms in 50 years, and the second only in this century. I think that's not insignificant, and there's a reason that happened. And the reason is that we are riding the wave of the most remarkable economy on the face of this planet. And that was a tough decision, my friends, in 1993 that got us there. Not one Republican joined us in voting for the Deficit Reduction Act of 1993. And it cost us the House of Representatives and the Senate. You can talk to any congressperson who lost their race, and they'll tell you what the one single overriding issue was of 1994. And it was that vote in which the fact that 1% of America saw their taxes go up, they nevertheless used that very effectively in the election as against everybody, and that became the dominant issue, coupled with some of the problems the administration had had on the health care plan and the fact that the first 2 years were not as good as the latter six had been. So the Congress was lost. But all the prior years of President Reagan, I was there for much of Reagan. I got to Congress in 1985. And I will tell you that for all of the efforts of our passing the Graham-Rudman-Hollings Deficit Reduction Act and all of the efforts of Reagan's talk, it was his veto pen that could have reduced the deficit any single year. And he never did it, nor did George Bush. And it wasn't until 93 that we started actually reducing the deficit and creating this very strict budgeting process by which we now need 60 votes to move money from one section of the budget to any other, and you've got to have an offset. It's as tough and as strict as it's been. Result, we're paying down $260 billion on the debt of the United States of America for the first time since World War II. We've got more women-owned businesses than any time in American history, more home ownership than any time. We've created 22 million new jobs. We're moving people into the information technology. We've created a Family Medical Leave Act. We've put, I think about 5 to 10 million kids now have health care coverage, and that's expanding. And I think you saw us successfully stand up for what we thought were international principles and standards in a number of different countries around the world. And I think that will be written about. Now, obviously, no paragraph, no fair assessment of the president's tenure is going to be absent an early mention of impeachment and of what happened. But my sense is history will begin to get it more correctly. I mean, that will be, a sad down point in his legacy. And everybody has to accept that. And he does. I know that. But measured against that will be an extraordinary period of partisanship on the other side, a rather remarkable long series of investigations that made this administration the most investigated administration in American history, which makes it difficult for anybody to get anything done. And I think in the end, people will measure that he did pretty well on the issues of substance, notwithstanding that particular personal failure that will be documented and recorded appropriately. But I think he will not be I think he will be recorded as a good president, as a president who missed the potential for greatness only because of the personal piece.
Thank you, Senator. We have unfortunately reached the point in the program where we have time for one last question. This came in a variety of forms, but essentially it was, how would you feel about being vice president?
Well, I'd give you a variety of answers, too. it's a job that I think has grown in recent years, and I think the model has become one that if any person in public life suggested to you that it's not a job of increased responsibility and potential, they'd be lying and they'd disqualify themselves. On the other hand, it's not a job that you campaign for or express any desire for or ought to try to. It's a very personalized kind of thing between a nominee and his needs in terms of getting elected and being president. And so my take on it is that it's all speculative right now. I'm not particularly spending very much time thinking about it. And you kind of take those things as they come along, and we'll see. If I get a call and say, will you talk about it? I've said publicly, sure, I'll talk about it. But again, I think the portfolio is critical. The relationship definition is critical. And you better be pretty clear about what that is, because it's a tough job with a lot of downsides. And so, it's sort of a who knows, let's see. And thank you very, very much for the privilege of being here today. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Our thanks to the Honorable Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts for joining us today. We also thank our audience here in San Francisco, as well as those listening on the radio. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and the World Affairs Council of Northern California is adjourned.